Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight we travel to 1930s Florence, where Hercule Poirot and Captain Hastings receive a summons from the elegant Lady Bianca di Rossi. The influential Count di Rossi has been found dead in his private study, and the palazzo is thick with unease. This is Death in the Palazzo, an original mystery inspired by the real 1911 case of Count Francesco Bonmartini, whose death sent shockwaves through Italy, yet told entirely in our own voice, in homage to the genius of Agatha Christie. Before we begin, pray enlighten us in the comments. What precise activity occupies your little grey cells as you listen to the unfolding of this tale? Are you walking through rain-slick streets preparing supper, or enjoying a quiet moment before bed? Your presence here truly fuels these mysteries. Producing these tales, writing, narrating, illustrating, takes many hours, and direct listener support allows us to keep creating them to the standard you enjoy. If you'd like to help ensure Nocturnal Tales continues, you can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive stories, or leave a small tip. Every contribution, large or small, helps keep the lights burning in our world of mystery. Now, let the story unfold. Chapter 1. The Count is Dead. It was in early October of 1928 that Poirot and I stepped off the train at Santa Maria Novella Station, Florence. A pale autumn sun shone down upon the city, its light diffused through a veil of high clouds. The air carried the mingled scent of roasting chestnuts, coal smoke from the locomotives, and the faint perfume of drying leaves. It was my first visit to Florence in several years, and I was once more struck by the improbable harmony of color and proportion in everything one saw. The warm ochre of the buildings, the cool marble of the churches, the serene arches of the bridges across the Arno. Our journey had been prompted by a letter, written in a neat, decisive hand, from Lady Bianca Visconti, an Englishwoman who had married into one of Florence's oldest and most illustrious families. I had known Lady Bianca in passing during my army days, a tall, graceful woman with a certain air of detachment, as though she were perpetually observing the world rather than living in it. Her marriage to Count Alessandro Visconti, a man of vast estates and an even vaster temper, had been a subject of much society gossip in London before they settled in Italy. Her note had been brief. "My dear Monsieur Poirot, I have need of your counsel in a matter most delicate. There are whispers here that could, if unchecked, destroy lives. I beg you to come to Florence at once, and to bring with you the gentleman who is your friend and chronicler. Time is of the essence." To my mind, the request was tantalizingly vague. I pressed Poirot for particulars during our passage from Dover to Calais, and again on the train through the Italian countryside, but my friend merely twirled his moustache and said, "Patience, Hastings. A mystery is like a souffle. If you open the oven door too soon, poof, it collapses." We were met at the station by a chauffeur in a long grey overcoat and peaked cap, standing beside a gleaming black Lancia. His expression was as impassive as a statue's. Our luggage was dispatched to the rear of the car, and within minutes we were gliding through the city streets, the river of traffic parting before us. Florence in October is a city between seasons. The summer visitors had gone, leaving the piazzas quieter, the cafes populated by locals once more. The facades of Renaissance palazzi glowed in the mild light, and here and there in a courtyard glimpsed through an open gate, one could see lemon trees in terracotta pots and hear the splashing of a fountain. Poirot, I observed, was unusually silent. He sat upright, gloved hands neatly folded on the head of his stick, eyes darting from building to building. "Regard, Hastings," he murmured as we crossed the Piazza della Signoria. "It is a city that is precise, ordered. The lines, the symmetry. Ah, Florence and Hercule Poirot, we understand each other." The Visconti Palazzo stood in a quieter quarter of the city, a stately edifice of warm, honey-colored stone. Its windows, set deep into the walls, were adorned with carved stone lintels, and the great entrance door, bound with iron studs, seemed designed to keep the centuries at bay. Inside, the air was cool and faintly scented with beeswax polish and the lingering trace of lilies. Lady Bianca received us in a salon, whose frescoed ceiling depicted a riot of cupids and garlands in faded but still charming colors. She was dressed in a gown of dove-gray silk, simple but perfectly cut, and wore no jewelry save for a narrow bracelet of silver. Her hair, dark and waved in the modern style, framed a face that had grown thinner since I had last seen her, and her eyes, though still striking, seemed to carry a weight of sleepless nights. "I am so grateful you could come, Monsieur Poirot." "Captain Hastings," she said, her voice low and precise. "I hardly know how to begin, but there have been whispers. And in Florence, whispers can be dangerous." Poirot inclined his head. "You speak, madame, of those social murmurs that may bruise the reputation, or of whispers to which the police might give their attention?" A faint color rose in her cheeks. "Both, I fear." I leaned forward, puzzled. "Is there some matter of theft, perhaps? Or a misunderstanding?" She interrupted, her tone calm but resolute. "No misunderstanding, Captain Hastings. My husband is dead." There was a short silence, broken only by the faint ticking of an ornate mantel clock. "Dead?" I repeated stupidly. "But when—" "Yesterday morning," she said. "He was found in his private study. The police believe it was murder." Poirot's gaze sharpened, though his voice remained as soft as ever. "And the whispers, madam?" Her eyes flickered towards the tall double doors, as if to be sure they were closed. "They say it was I who killed him." Lady Bianca did not flinch under Poirot's gaze. "You see, Monsieur Alessandro and I had been estranged for some time. He was a man of intense passions and equally intense jealousies. In the first years of our marriage he could be charming, attentive, but in the last two there were quarrels. Oh, nothing for the servants to hear, nothing that could be called public, but bitter words all the same." Her hands rested lightly on the carved arm of her chair, but I noticed the faintest tightening of her fingers as she spoke. "Estranged?" Poirot prompted. "Yes. He insisted upon spending much of his time at the Villa del Rose, a property in the hills outside the city. He entertained guests there, guests I did not know, and some I was not permitted to meet." She gave a faint, humorless smile. "Alessandro had an idea of marriage that was perhaps more common in the 16th century than the 20th. A wife should be an ornament in public, silent in matters of the heart, and infinitely patient in private." "And yesterday morning?" Poirot asked gently. She drew a breath. "He returned to the palazzo 2 nights ago, unexpectedly. I had been at the opera with friends, and when I came home I found him in his study. We exchanged only the briefest words. The next morning I went riding early with my cousin, Signorina Teresa Bardi. When I returned, the police were here. They told me Alessandro had been found by the valet at 9 o'clock, seated at his desk, but quite dead." I could not help myself. "Good Lord, how?" "At first they thought it a seizure, until they saw the blood." "Blood?" I asked, startled. She inclined her head. "A wound to the side of his head. The coroner believes he was struck, once, with considerable force. An antique bronze inkwell lay on the floor beside him, its edge darkened." "The police say it must be the weapon?" Poirot raised a finger delicately. "And the study, was it in disorder?" "No, that is the curious thing. Nothing appeared stolen. His watch and cufflinks were still on the desk, his wallet in his breast pocket. It was as though—" she faltered, "as though whoever did it wanted only him dead, and nothing more." Poirot's eyes half closed. "And who else was in the house that morning, madame?" Myself, Teresa the valet, and our housekeeper, Signora Bellini. Alessandro's secretary, Carlo Mazzetti, arrived just before the police. She paused, then added, "The whispers began almost at once." "I imagine you can guess why."
"Because of the estrangement," I suggested.
"That, and the fact that Alessandro had made certain accusations about me. Wild, absurd things. That I was unfaithful." She straightened her back, the muscles in her neck taut. "I do not pretend our marriage was a happy one, Captain Hastings, but I did not kill him." Poirot's voice was courteous, but there was an edge to it. "And the accusations, were they entirely without foundation?"
"Entirely," she said without hesitation. "The Count could be imaginative. If I so much as spoke twice to the same gentleman at a soiree, he would insist I had taken a lover."
She hesitated, then allowed herself a brief, rueful laugh. "Florentine society, monsieur, delights in scandal. A lady walking unchaperoned with a man is enough to set tongues wagging for a fortnight."
Poirot inclined his head gravely. "And yet, madame, the tongues wag louder when the man is found dead."
For the first time I saw a shadow of real fear in her eyes. "That is why I sent for you. I can bear unkind gossip, monsieur, but I cannot bear the thought of standing in a courtroom, accused of my husband's murder, with no one to defend the truth." She stood then, as if to end the interview, but her composure wavered for the briefest moment. "Monsieur Poirot, I did not love my husband, but I did not wish for his death. I beg of you, help me prove it."
Poirot rose and made a slight bow. "Madame, when the good name of a lady is in question, Hercule Poirot cannot be indifferent. I will take this matter in hand."
Her shoulders relaxed minutely. "You will speak to the police?"
"In due course," said Poirot. "First, I must speak to the valet who found the body, and to those who last saw the Count alive. You will assist me by ensuring that the household remains, how do you say, intact. No one leaves, no one arrives. We?"
Lady Bianca gave a small nod, her dark eyes fixed on him. As we took our leave, I could not help but remark,
"You believe her innocent, then?"
Poirot smiled faintly. "Mon ami, I believe nothing, yet. But I know this. In Florence, every stone has a history, and every heart a secret. We shall uncover both, n'est-ce pas?" Outside, the city glowed in the mellow autumn light. Somewhere a church bell tolled the hour, and a flight of pigeons wheeled above the rooftops. But in my mind's eye I saw only the silent figure of the dead Count, and the dark smear upon the edge of a Renaissance inkwell.
Chapter 2. Faces in the Palazzo.
Lady Bianca herself conducted us along a cool, dim corridor whose flagstones were worn smooth by centuries of footsteps. The ceilings arched high above us, frescoed in soft blues and golds. We passed a series of salons, each furnished in the heavy elegance of an older age. Carved walnut, velvet drapes, oil portraits in gilded frames. "The study is this way," she said, "but before you see it, there are people you should meet." The first was Teresa Bardi, Lady Bianca's cousin. A striking young woman in her early 20s, she had glossy black hair swept back from her forehead and the kind of pale, luminous skin that Italian painters seem to favor. She rose from a low armchair with a certain languid grace, and I noticed her eyes, large, dark, and watchful, gave the impression of weighing one's worth before offering a smile. "You have come to help Bianca," she said, in lightly accented English. "That is good. She will need friends." Poirot inclined his head.
"And you, mademoiselle, you were with Lady Bianca yesterday morning?"
"Yes. We rode out together to the Cascine. We returned just before 10.
Poirot's voice was courteous.
"And on this ride, did the conversation touch upon the Count?"
Teresa tilted her head slightly.
"We spoke of many things. Horses, the weather, the color of the leaves by the river, but not of Alessandro, not directly. Why should we?
It was a fine morning.
But you knew he was in the house? Poirot persisted.
Of course. He returned the night before. I saw him in the hall. He greeted me, politely.
There was the faintest hesitation before the last word.
I went to my room first, to change. Then I heard voices in the hall and... commotion.
Her gaze drifted momentarily to the window. Giulio was speaking quickly to Signora Bellini. I went down to see what was wrong. That was when I learned Alessandro was dead. Her tone was even, but I could not shake the feeling that she was choosing her words with care, like a fencer measuring each thrust.
Poirot asked, "You were fond of the Count, perhaps?"
A pause.
"He could be difficult," she said, "but he was never dull. He noticed things about people that others missed. It is a rare quality."
She glanced at Poirot with a faint smile, as though daring him to interpret her meaning.
"Still, I preferred to keep my distance."
"And yet," Poirot's voice softened, "you live here, in his house."
"My cousin invited me," she said simply. "Bianca is like a sister to me, and in Florence, family protects family."
It was a curious choice of words. As we moved on, I glanced back. Teresa was watching us go, a faint, unreadable smile on her lips. Next, we were presented to Signora Bellini, the housekeeper, a stout woman in her 50s with a brisk, capable air, the sort who could manage a household of 50 without raising her voice. She wore a dark wool dress and a spotless white apron, her graying hair drawn into a severe knot. She curtsied to Poirot, gave me a polite nod, and clasped her hands before her.
"It was Giulio who came to me," she began. "I was in the kitchen warming the milk for the coffee. He looked pale, not frightened exactly, but as if he had been running. He said the Count was not waking. I told him perhaps the padrone had fallen asleep over his papers, as he sometimes did after a journey, but Giulio said, 'No, Signora, it is not like that.' So I went upstairs at once." She glanced between us as if to be sure we were following.
"The Count was sitting in his chair at the desk. His head was bent over his right shoulder. At first I thought he was only resting. I spoke to him, softly, because the family were still abed.
When he did not answer, I stepped closer. That is when I saw the mark here." She touched her temple with two fingers. "A dark patch, and the skin broken."
Poirot inclined his head. "You did not touch the body?"
"I did not. It is not my place. I told Giulio to fetch the doctor, and I went to find the Contessa. I told her only that the Count was unwell. It is not good to give a shock all at once."
"And the room itself, Signora?"
"Everything was in order," she said firmly. "The Count liked it that way. The papers on the desk were stacked neatly, the pens in their holder, the lamp lit. I remember the light because the curtains were still drawn, though the sun was up." She hesitated.
"There was a drawer not quite shut, the middle one. I saw it when I walked around to open the curtains. I thought perhaps the Count had been working in it. He kept all sorts of little things there, sealing wax, stamps, his spectacles."
Poirot's eyes narrowed a fraction.
"Nothing else struck you as unusual?"
She shook her head.
"Not then."
"Only later, when the police came, I thought it odd that his watch was in the drawer. The Count always wore it in the mornings, even if he was not going out."
Poirot made no comment, but I could see his moustache twitch slightly.
"You have been long in the household, Signora?"
17 years, monsieur. I keep the linen, the silver, the keys. I know when something is as it should be and when it is not.
But what happened in that room?"
She lifted her shoulders.
"That is for the police to decide. I keep to my work. That is how I have kept my position all these years."
Giulio, the valet, was a narrow-shouldered fellow in his early 30s with slicked back hair and a small moustache that might have been drawn with a ruler. His dark eyes flicked from Poirot to me and back again, as though measuring how much to say.
"It was I who took in the breakfast," he began, speaking in deliberate English. 8:30, as always.
coffee, rolls, a little fruit. The Count was at the desk writing. He told me to leave it on the side table. He seemed thoughtful.
Poirot's tone was light. And when you returned?
I brought the post just after 9. I knocked. No answer. I thought perhaps he was reading, so I stepped in. He was still in the chair, head bent, as if asleep. But when I called to him, nothing. I came closer. Then I saw...
Giulio touched his temple.
The mark. And the inkwell on the floor. I knew at once.
You went to fetch the doctor? Poirot asked.
I went first to the Contessa, Giulio said promptly. She is mistress of the house. She must be told before anyone else.
That struck me as curious. Teresa had claimed Giulio gave the news directly to Lady Bianca, yet Signora Bellini had insisted she was the one to do so.
You did not go to Signora Bellini? Poirot asked, as though the matter were unimportant.
Giulio hesitated. I passed her, yes, perhaps I said something. But I thought it best the Contessa should know at once. She is the lady of the house.
Poirot changed the subject. And how was the Count's mood these past days?
Giulio's eyes flickered again. He had returned from the villa suddenly. There had been quarrels. The Count was a man who noticed everything, and sometimes imagined more. The Contessa and Signor Mazzetti, the secretary. They spoke often in the library, in the garden. Too often, perhaps. And the Signorina Bardi. Here he hesitated, glancing towards the corridor. She was always close to the Count. In this house, monsieur, closeness can be as dangerous as anger.
And did the quarrels concern such closeness? Poirot prompted gently.
Giulio gave the faintest shrug. I am only the valet. I hear voices. I see faces. I do not ask what they mean. But 2 nights ago, the Count went first to the Signorina's rooms, then to the Contessa's. After that, there was no laughter in the dining room. Poirot's gaze rested on him a moment longer, but his voice remained courteous.
Merci, monsieur. That will be all, for now.
As Giulio withdrew, I could not help feeling that his careful half-answers had been designed to do exactly the opposite of reassuring us. We found the Count's secretary in a narrow, book-lined room at the far end of the corridor. Afternoon light slanted through high windows, striping the desk with gold. Papers lay in tidy stacks beside a brass letter scale. The arrangement was as precise as the man who rose to greet us. Carlo Mazzetti was tall and spare, his charcoal suit perfectly pressed, his dark hair drawn back from a high forehead. His movements had a certain deliberate economy, as if each gesture had been weighed before execution.
"Monsieur Poirot, Captain Hastings," he said in excellent English. "Lady Bianca tells me you are making inquiries."
Poirot inclined his head.
"A few, yes. You worked closely with the Count?"
"For nearly 7 years. I managed his correspondence, accounts, and accompanied him when business required. One might say I knew him well, though I doubt anyone truly did."
"You were not here when he died?"
"I was returning from the post office. There was commotion in the hall. Giulio told me the news."
"And when did you last see him alive?"
2 nights before at the villa. We discussed legal documents. He seemed distracted, irritable. I gathered he meant to return to Florence the next day."
"Lady Bianca says his return was unexpected."
"With the Count, changes were expected. He valued his independence."
"Were there quarrels between him and the Contessa?"
Mazzetti's reply was measured.
"I am her cousin by marriage, monsieur. It is not my place to comment on private matters."
"Yet you spoke with her often," Poirot said mildly. "We shared responsibilities. The Count's affairs were complex. Decisions had to be made in his absence."
"And the Count did not approve?"
A faint pause. "In those final months he approved of very little. His temper had grown unpredictable. I feared it might cause a breach."
Poirot regarded him steadily.
"On the morning of his death, the Count's watch was found in his desk drawer. Was that usual?"
Mazzetti's composure wavered. No, he wore it every day, unless... He stopped, then added, unless he expected a private meeting and wished not to be reminded of the hour.
Poirot made no comment.
Merci, Monsieur Mazzetti.
Out in the corridor, I asked, well, Poirot, what do you think of him? Poirot's smile was unreadable. A man who measures every syllable, mon ami, and in the spaces between them, much may be learned.
Chapter 3. The Study of the Dead.
Lady Bianca led us to the Count's private study, a corner room with tall shuttered windows. The air was faintly stale, as though it had been closed since the morning of the murder. Heavy curtains of dark green damask framed the windows, and a great mahogany desk stood square to the room, its surface fastidiously arranged. The inkwell, an ornate bronze piece shaped like a crouching lion, lay on the carpet near the desk's corner. Its edge was darkened, the stain catching the light in a way that made me turn aside. Poirot bent over it, careful not to touch. "The police think this the weapon, yes?" Lady Bianca inclined her head. "The coroner believes so. The blow was struck from behind, with considerable force." Poirot's gaze moved slowly over the desk. A stack of neatly folded correspondence, an open blotter, a heavy fountain pen. He crouched before the middle drawer, which stood half an inch ajar. "Madame," he asked quietly, "was it found like this?"
"I believe so. Signora Bellini noticed it when she came to the room."
Poirot took out his handkerchief and eased it open. Inside lay a velvet-lined tray containing a gold pocket watch, its chain coiled neatly beside it. Several personal items occupied the compartments: sealing wax, an ivory-handled magnifying glass, a small leather case of visiting cards. Beneath the tray, however, was something else, a bundle of envelopes bound with thin green ribbon. Poirot lifted them with infinite care, turning them so that only we could see. The envelopes were addressed not to the Count, but to A.V. in a flowing feminine hand. None bore a return address. All were postmarked from different towns in Tuscany. Lady Bianca's brows drew together. "I have never seen those before." Poirot untied the ribbon and glanced at the first page, his expression unreadable. "They are of a personal nature," he said at last, retying the bundle. "The signature is always the same, an initial only."
"What initial?" I asked.
"An L," he replied softly, slipping the letters back beneath the tray. "We will speak of them again, Hastings, but not here." He opened the other drawers in turn. The right-hand one held writing paper, envelopes, and a sheaf of bank statements. The left was filled with household bills, neatly labeled keys, and a heavy leather-bound ledger. Poirot noted each with the delicacy of a jeweler appraising gemstones. He then crossed to the curtains, running a gloved finger along the edge. "The dust is disturbed here, as though someone drew them sharply shut."
"They were drawn when the body was found," Lady Bianca said.
Poirot glanced at the desk lamp.
"And yet the lamp was lit. A man who wishes for light opens his curtains. A man who does not, perhaps, does not wish to be seen."
His eyes swept the carpet, lingering on faint depressions in the pile. "A chair once stood here, opposite the Count. It has since been moved back to the wall." Lady Bianca looked startled. "The police did not mention it."
"They may have noticed, but not remarked. I, however, remark everything."
Poirot straightened. "Madam, I will trouble you no further in this room for now. But I will speak again to each person in the household, and I will begin with Giulio. His steps from the hall to this door, they are of interest to me."
"And why is that?"
I asked as we left.
"Because, mon ami," said Poirot, "when a man's account changes, it is not always his memory that is at fault. Sometimes it is his purpose."
Chapter 4.
The name that was not spoken. We returned to the salon where Lady Bianca had first received us. Poirot declined coffee, which for him was remarkable, and instead took a seat where he could command a view of the door. "Hastings," he murmured, "you will observe today not with your eyes, but with your reactions. I will throw a stone into the pond and watch for the ripples." One by one, members of the household were summoned under the pretext of clarifying small details. Teresa Bardi came first, her dark eyes bright and questioning. "Mademoiselle," Poirot began conversationally, "in sorting the Count's papers, I came across a curious matter. It seems there were letters, charmingly written, full of sentiment, signed only with the letter L. I wonder, do you know of them?" If Teresa was startled, she hid it well. Her smile remained fixed, though the hand resting on the arm of her chair tightened imperceptibly. "No," she said lightly. "The Count had many acquaintances. I could not know them all." "Indeed," Poirot murmured. "Yet these letters were kept close to hand, in his desk, beneath the tray. A place of value, mademoiselle." Teresa tilted her head. "Perhaps they were from a tradesman. Linen, lace, leather. There are many L's in commerce." Poirot inclined his head, and she departed without another word. "Une onde," he said softly to me. "One ripple." Signora Bellini entered next, her expression one of brisk cooperation. When Poirot mentioned the letters, she gave a short laugh. "A valet might know his master's secrets, monsieur, but a housekeeper is not a spy. If he kept letters, they were his affair. I touch only the linen." Her reaction was genuine enough, yet Poirot still made a note. Then came Giulio. At the first mention of letters signed L, his gaze flicked to the mantel clock, then back to Poirot. "Perhaps from a friend of his youth," he said, his voice carefully neutral. "The Count had many friendships." "Friendships that caused quarrels, perhaps?" Poirot's tone was mild. Giulio hesitated. "There were quarrels, yes. But I do not ask the reasons." "You have already told me," Poirot said quietly, "that two nights ago the Count visited Signorina Bardi's rooms, then the Contessa's. This morning you said you went first to the Contessa with news of his death, but Signora Bellini says you told her first, which is correct?" A muscle worked in Giulio's jaw. "Perhaps I saw them both almost at once. It was a confused moment." "Mais non, monsieur," Poirot said, his voice now very gentle. "Confusion is when one forgets details. You are not confused. You are careful. There is a difference." Giulio's eyes darkened, but he said nothing further. Poirot dismissed him with a courteous nod. When the door closed, Poirot's mustache twitched. "He fears something, Hastings, and it is not the police." "At last, we sent for Carlo Mazzetti." The secretary entered with his usual composure, though his eyes moved briefly from Poirot's face to the desk, as if calculating what might be in play. "Monsieur Mazzetti," Poirot began, "you were close to the Count. I wonder if you can explain the presence of a bundle of letters in his desk, signed only with the letter L." For the first time I saw a flicker of uncertainty cross Mazzetti's features. "Letters?" "Yes, written in a feminine hand, posted from various towns in Tuscany, and clearly of a personal nature. You had no knowledge of them?" Mazzetti's gaze shifted to the window before returning to Poirot. "No, monsieur. But if they were there, I can only assume they were from someone the Count valued." "Someone his wife did not know about?" "I cannot speak to that," Mazzetti said crisply. "The Count was a private man in certain matters." Poirot leaned forward slightly. "And yet, in the final weeks, his temper grew unsettled. Might the author of these letters have had something to do with that?" Mazzetti's reply came too quickly. "No.
Poirot let the silence stretch until it became faintly uncomfortable. Then he said, "You handle the Count's correspondence. It is curious these letters escaped your notice."
"They must have been delivered to him privately," Mazzetti said at last. "In such cases he preferred to keep them apart."
Poirot's eyes glimmered. "Ah, apart. Yes, I see. That will be all, monsieur." When we were alone again, I could not contain myself. "Poirot, do you believe this L could be the key to the whole thing?"
"My dear Hastings," he said, rising, "in a case of murder, the key is often a lady, but one must be certain she exists before attempting to unlock the door."
When Mazzetti had gone, Poirot stood a moment in thought, the fingertips of both hands pressed together. Then he rang for the maid and asked that Lady Bianca join us. She entered with her usual poise, though there was a faint weariness about her eyes. "You have been questioning the household," she said. "I trust you have learned something." Poirot inclined his head. "I have learned that every person here has an opinion, madame, though some prefer to give it in glances rather than words. But it is you, the mistress of the house, whose thoughts I value most." She gave a short, almost ironic laugh. "My thoughts, monsieur, are not worth much. I have been told my husband was murdered. I have been told the police suspect me. I have had no sleep, little appetite, and I am expected to receive visitors as though this were merely an inconvenient interruption to the season." Her voice had sharpened, but she quickly reined it in. "Forgive me, I am tired." Poirot's gaze softened. "Fatigue can be dangerous, madame. It tempts one to speak with more candor than is prudent. Sometimes that is a gift to the investigator, and sometimes to the enemy." She met his eyes steadily. "Then I will choose my candor carefully. What do you wish to know?" "There is a bundle of letters in your husband's desk, letters signed only with the initial L. Do you know their origin?" A pause. "Not long, but measured. No, I never saw them."
"You do not even hazard a guess?" "I have no need to guess, monsieur. Alessandro's infidelities were rarely conducted in secrecy. If these letters are what you imply, they belong to the past, and the past no longer concerns me."
Poirot tilted his head.
"Even when the past walks into the present, armed with an inkwell."
For the first time, her composure wavered. "If you mean to ask whether jealousy drove me to kill my husband, the answer is no. And if you mean to suggest that some woman from his past has done so, then I beg you, find her. For every day she is not found, suspicion will fall on me."
She rose then, her hands lightly clasped before her.
"Monsieur Poirot, I did not love Alessandro, but I will not have his murder pinned to me merely because it suits the gossips of Florence. That is the truth."
Poirot bowed slightly. "Then I will see that the truth is heard."
Chapter 5. Ripples in the Courtyard. The next morning broke pale and cool, the streets outside still damp from a night rain. At breakfast, Poirot announced, in that tone which brooked no debate, that he would take a little air in the city.
"You will remain here, Hastings," he added, buttering a roll with meticulous care. "I have certain errands that require discretion, and your presence is conspicuous."
"Conspicuous," I said rather indignantly.
"My friend, you have the face of a man who believes everything he hears."
"Such a face invites confidences, and perhaps today that will be more useful here than in the post offices of Florence." He left in the Black Lancia shortly after, clutching a small envelope which I suspected contained one of the mysterious letters. The palazzo was quieter than usual. The rain had brought a chill, and I wandered into the inner courtyard, where the orange trees glistened and the fountain murmured softly. I had just settled into a wrought-iron chair when I heard voices, low but urgent, drifting from the covered walkway on the far side. It was Teresa Bardi and Giulio.
"Told you not to speak of it," she was saying.
"I said nothing, niente.
Julia replied quickly. But the little man, he asks too many questions. He knows about the letters.
There was a pause.
I could almost feel Teresa's glance sweeping the courtyard before she said, If he finds out who wrote them...
He won't, Julio interrupted. Not unless someone tells him. And if that happens... His voice dropped lower. Then we are all finished.
My chair scraped faintly as I shifted and the sound seemed to carry. The conversation stopped at once. A moment later, Teresa emerged into the courtyard, smiling far too brightly.
Captain Hastings, she said, enjoying the morning?
Very, I replied, rising to my feet. She nodded and continued on without another word, Julio following a few paces behind, his eyes fixed firmly on the ground. I was about to return indoors when the soft click of a side door caught my ear. Stepping quietly into the shadow of an archway, I saw Lady Bianca emerge from the library, Carlo Mazzetti just behind her. They paused in the covered passageway, speaking in voices too low for the servants to overhear, but just loud enough for me, concealed where I was, to catch the cadence of their exchange.
"You should not have come to me this morning," Bianca said, her tone low but urgent. "Not with the police here. It will only make them talk more."
I came because you are alone in this, Mazzetti replied, his voice tight. They will twist everything, if they find those letters.
They already have, she interrupted. Poirot mentioned them yesterday.
Mazzetti swore under his breath.
Then you must be ready. If he thinks they are yours...
They're not mine, Bianca snapped, her composure cracking for the briefest instant. She drew a slow breath.
But if Alessandro believed they were, then perhaps it explains why.
She stopped herself abruptly, glancing down the corridor.
You know what that would mean for both of us, Mazzetti said softly. Her gaze held his for a moment longer than was necessary.
Yes, I know. They separated without another word, Bianca disappearing into the salon, Mazzetti back into the library. I remained in my hiding place a moment longer, the sound of the fountain filling the quiet. There was something in the way they had spoken, not the familiarity of lovers, but the mutual caution of people bound by a dangerous knowledge. When Poirot returned just after noon, I recounted both what I had overheard from Teresa and Julio and the meeting between Bianca and Mazzetti. He listened without interruption, then tapped his fingertips together.
Très intéressant. You see, Hastings, you remain here, and the truths come to you like bees to the flower. Now I too have information. But mine was fetched from three different postmasters and a very obliging clerk in the Central Telegraph Office.
And? I prompted. Poirot's moustache quivered. The letters were posted from Siena, Lucca, and a small village near Livorno. Three different places, yet all within reach of one person who is most certainly in Florence today. The pattern is becoming clear.
Before I could ask further, he rang for the maid. Be so good as to gather the household in the salon at once, he instructed. Within minutes, Lady Bianca, Teresa, Giulio, Signora Bellini, and Carlo Mazzetti were assembled. The autumn light slanted through the tall windows, catching the gilt edges of picture frames. Poirot stood before the fireplace, the bronze inkwell in one hand and the bundle of L letters in the other.
"Mesdames, messieurs," he began, "we are here to perform a little reconstruction. The Count was seated thus." He placed a chair at the desk. "And here sat his visitor." Words were exchanged, tempers perhaps rose. Then, crack, the inkwell descended. One blow, death. He set the inkwell down with a deliberate thud. All eyes were fixed upon him. "In his desk we find this, a packet of letters, tied with green ribbon. They are signed only with the letter L. Their author is in this room." A ripple ran through the gathering. Teresa's lips curved faintly. Giulio's gaze flickered. Mazzetti stood very still. Lady Bianca's expression was unreadable. He turned to the group at large. "We will speak of these letters again in a moment. But first, I will ask you each to take the chair where the visitor sat, one by one." And so, like a director arranging his cast, Poirot began to set the stage for what I felt sure would be his final act.
Chapter 6. The Visitor Behind the Curtains. The rain had rinsed the sky to a pale Florentine blue by the time we assembled once more in the great salon. The shutters stood ajar, the light fell in clean rectangles across the carpet. Poirot, very trim and very calm, stood by the hearth with the bronze inkwell on the mantel and the green-ribboned packet of letters upon the table.
"Mesdames, messieurs," he said softly, "as promised, we shall speak one by one. We return, each of us, to that morning, precisely as it was." He drew a chair into the center.
"This, you will remember, is the chair that was moved and then pushed back to the wall. Before it was moved, it stood opposite the Count's desk. A visitor sat in it. The curtains were drawn, though the lamp was lit. Pourquoi? Because the visitor did not wish to be seen from the courtyard." He looked round the room. "Mademoiselle Bardi, if you please." Teresa crossed the carpet with feline grace and seated herself. Her dark eyes met Poirot's steadily. "You rode with Lady Bianca," said Poirot, "and returned just before 10. Yet the valet brought breakfast at 8:30 and found the Count thoughtful, expecting to be left undisturbed. He put his watch away. Very unusual, as Signora Bellini remarked. A man puts away his watch when he intends to forget the hour. And someone drew the curtains before the sun was full. That someone was the expected visitor." A faint color rose in Teresa's cheeks.
"You have no proof I came here," she said evenly.
"Maisie," said Poirot very gently. He touched the green ribbon. "I noticed it when I examined the desk. Yesterday I quietly confirmed with your maid that you keep your hat boxes and glove cases tied with this same ribbon. The hand that wrote the letters signed only L. Your baptismal names, mademoiselle, are Teresa Lucia Bardi."
Lady Bianca's head snapped round, her eyes hard upon her cousin.
"Is this true?"
Teresa met her gaze.
"Yes," she said simply. "I loved him."
The Contessa's voice was low but edged like glass. "Under my roof, in my house, you have brought disgrace on yourself and shame into my name." Teresa's hands tightened on the chair arms, but she did not speak. Poirot inclined his head. "You came that morning by the side stair, crossed the anteroom, and sat where you are seated now. He had your letters in the drawer. Words were exchanged. Perhaps there were tears. But when you left him, he was alive." He motioned. She rose, chin high, and stepped aside.
"Signora Bellini."
The housekeeper sat like a figure of judgment.
"Signora," said Poirot, "you noticed what others missed. The watch in the drawer, the curtains drawn. You keep the keys and the habits of the house in your head. It is you who told the police the hour, you who saw the middle drawer not quite shut. Yet you did not touch the body. You disturbed nothing. For that disciplined mind, je vous félicite, only one thing you overlooked, the chair's faint mark upon the carpet."
"Because I looked at the dead, not the furniture," she said crisply. "I run a house, not an inquiry."
"Just so," said Poirot with a little bow. "You may go." "Giulio?" The valet advanced, silent and sleek. He sat with his knees close together, eyes lowered.
"You told me," said Poirot, "that you took in breakfast at 8:30. You were told to leave it on the side table and go, which was unusual since the Count habitually took coffee at the desk. You returned with the post a little after 9 and found him unresponsive. Twice you have altered one small detail, whether you fetched first the housekeeper or the Contessa. Such inconsistency is not a mistake. It is a purpose. You wished to control who learned first that there had been a visitor." Giulio's lips parted. "I wished to spare the lady's scandal," he muttered. You wished, said Poirot, to spare one lady especially. You knew of the letters. Once, at least, you posted them for her on your morning out. The postmarks are from Siena Luca, a village near Livorno, convenient to a gentleman's day errand from Florence. You are loyal, yes, but your loyalty is to the person who gave you the envelopes. Giulio's eyes dropped. She is kind to me, he said quietly. I did not want her name in it.
You may step back. Signor Mazzetti.
The secretary came with composed face and a very straight back. He did not sit until Poirot indicated the visitor's chair. Then he obeyed, folding his long hands together.
You manage the Count's papers, said Poirot pleasantly.
You know his habits, when he wears his watch, how he arranges his desk, even where he keeps his private things. You were not, you say, here at 9 o'clock. Yet the Central Telegraph Office tells me a gentleman answering to you sent a wire at 8 and 12 and was seen walking back by the river at 8:30. It is a 10-minute walk to the Palazzo. One arrives by 9, if one has a reason. Mazzetti's eyes flickered, then steadied. I had no reason, he said quietly.
On the contrary, Poirot murmured.
He took up the inkwell with a handkerchief, holding it like a prop. Your reason was jealousy, and love. Not love for Lady Bianca. That was the popular whisper, and it is false. You loved Teresa Bardi. There was the soft, shocked intake of a single breath, from Teresa. Poirot's voice did not rise. You discovered the letters. Perhaps not their hiding place in the drawer, but the fact of them. You learned 2 nights before that the Count had gone first to Signorina Bardi's rooms, then to his wife's. You feared what such a liaison would make of her, of Teresa, when he tired of her. In Italy, reputation is not a trifle. You went that morning to plead, to threaten, perhaps to bargain. The curtains were already drawn. Mademoiselle had just gone. The watch was in the drawer. He had chosen, for once, not to be ruled by the hour. You sat here, he touched the chair's back, and words became insults. He mocked you. He reached for the drawer where her letters lay, his trophy. And then, Poirot's hand descended an inch in air, there was the single blow.
No, said Teresa suddenly, low and fierce. No!
Mazzetti did not look at her, his gaze fixed on the bronze lion. When he spoke, his voice was steady, but it seemed to come from far away. He would have ruined her, he said. You do not know him as we did. He would have paraded her till the town had done with her. Then he would have snuffed her like a candle. I told him to end it, to give back the letters and let her go. He laughed. He said, his mouth tightened. The word did not come. I had the inkwell in my hand. I meant only to make him listen. One blow, said Poirot very softly. From behind and to the side, as the coroner found. The inkwell fell. You set the chair back to the wall, drew the curtains tighter, closed the drawer, but not quite. Then you went. When Giulio returned with the post, the Count was already dead. No one spoke. The fountain in the courtyard could be heard, faint and regular as a pulse. Teresa took a step forward.
Carlo, she whispered, why did you not come to me?
He turned his head at last, and for a moment I saw in his face something naked and simple, boyish almost. Because you loved him, he said.
And I?
He stopped, and the simplicity fell away like a mask.
Because I am a clerk, and he was a count.
She straightened. I loved him, she said, with the clear fatalism of her country. Or I thought I did. He made me feel alive, and then afraid. I tried to end it, but I failed. He had a hold over me. I was weak, that is all. Poirot inclined his head.
It is enough.
The inspector, who had been waiting discreetly in the vestibule, entered with 2 men. For a moment Mazzetti did not move. Then he stood, smoothed his cuffs as though for an appointment, and bowed slightly to Lady Bianca. I am sorry, he said. Lady Bianca's face was very pale, but her voice did not tremble. "I believe," she said quietly, "that you thought to do a kindness. It was not yours to do." They took him away without struggle. When the door had closed, the room seemed larger and very still. I found my voice. "Poirot," I said. "I was sure it would be Teresa." He shook his head. "Non, non, Hastings. The curtains told me a woman had been... the wish not to be seen. The watch told me there was to be an encounter of the heart. The chair told me two sat. But the single blow, cold, precise, and the neatness after?" He raised his eyebrows. "That was the hand of a man who lives by order. A secretary, not a lover in hysteria." "And the letters?" I asked. "The letters were the tinder," he said, picking up the green ribbon and letting it slip through his fingers. "In Italy, amour is a flame, very bright, very brief. But jealousy, ah, that is a coal that smoulders, and one day a man breathes upon it." He looked towards the tall windows, where the light had softened to a late afternoon gold. "In Florence," said Hercule Poirot, "the lines are perfect, the proportions exact. In the human heart, never. It is why men like me find employment." He offered Lady Bianca his arm and led her from the room. Epilogue. Winter in Florence. We came to Florence again in the first days of February. The hills were dusted with snow, the Arno ran swift and grey, and the whole city seemed wrapped in a kind of crystalline stillness. Poirot declared we would stop only for the briefest of hours, but I noticed his eyes following every turning of the streets, as if the stones themselves might yield a final word on the affair. In 3 months, Florence had swallowed the scandal as neatly as the Arno swallows a leaf. Mazzetti's trial in December had ended in a verdict of manslaughter, 7 years in prison, softened, no doubt, by influence and sympathy for a man driven by passion. The newspapers had made what they could of it, then turned their gaze to the carnival season. Teresa Bardi had retreated to her family's villa near Siena. There was talk of an engagement to a young count, impoverished but adoring, who seemed determined to overlook everything except her beauty. Lady Bianca, for her part, remained mistress of the Visconti Palazzo, though the household was smaller, the invitations fewer, and her manner, if possible, more composed than ever. Of Giulio the valet, I can say only that he remained silent and devoted, as if nothing had changed. Florence has a talent for erasing what it chooses to forget. The streets are the same, the cafes the same, the winter light falling at just the same angle as when we first arrived. And yet I could not pass the great wooden doors of the palazzo without remembering the echo of voices in the courtyard, the green ribbon in Poirot's hand, the bronze lion crouched on the carpet. It is one thing to admire the order of the city's marble facades, quite another to be reminded that behind them hearts beat as chaotically as anywhere. In Florence, beauty is perfect, proportion is exact, but passion cares nothing for symmetry. Postscript from the private papers of Hercule Poirot. Florence, February 1929. The Visconti affair stands as a most instructive demonstration of how crimes of passion are rarely uncalculated. Even the blow struck in jealous ardor must first traverse the corridors of intent. Mazzetti killed for love, certainly, but it was love tempered by wounded vanity and an instinctive desire for symmetry. The bronze inkwell fell with all the deliberation of a signature affixed to an irrevocable contract. Teresa Bardi, Lucia, as her letters dared to sign, proved the dangerous allure of youth clothed in self-dramatization. She courted peril as a coquette courts glances, never admitting she was enthralled until the consequences pressed close. Such women recover. Beauty and novelty are currencies whose value the world is loath to devalue. Lady Bianca emerged with her reputation unblemished, her household diminished, and her sovereignty over the palazzo undisturbed. She will speak of her cousin no more, but will wear her composure as an heirloom jewel. Outwardly flawless, concealing any flaw beneath the gold. As for Giulio, that quiet custodian of other people's indiscretions, his loyalty is of the kind that endures without question and without reward. In his creed, a lady's secret is inviolate, even when the lady would gladly be rid of it. Florence remains the eternal paradox. A city whose facades are the very embodiment of harmony and proportion, yet whose interiors conceal chambers of unrest, ambition, and folly. Here, beauty is but the lacquer. The passions beneath are as ill-arranged as anywhere in the world. For the present, equilibrium is restored. Yet symmetry is the most fragile of conditions, and in Florence, passion is patient. It waits in the shadows, biding its hour to tilt the scales anew, and when it does, Hercule Poirot shall be there to restore the balance. And so concludes Death in the Palazzo. If you've listened until the final word, you are part of the reason these mysteries continue to be told. Your comments, your sharing of our stories, and your direct support make it possible for Poirot's cases and Hastings' voice to reach listeners across the world. From the moment Lady Bianca's letter reaches Whitehaven Mansions to the final unmasking in the Palazzo, this story, like all our tales, has been crafted with time, care, and dedication. If you believe in what we're creating, consider joining our membership for ad-free access and exclusive stories, or leaving a tip to help bring the next mystery to life. Even the smallest gesture tells us, yes, keep going. Until our next case, buonanotte.